good partners with Africa are not because we're certain that everything will turn out all right, but because it is important. Because we're human beings, we can never expect everything to turn out all right. Africa is so incredibly diverse. Its people speak nearly 3,000 languages. It is not a single monolithic place of single monolithic truths, a place of many places, each defined by its own history and aspirations, its own successes and failures. I was struck on my trip to Africa by the differences between Ghana and Uganda, Botswana and Senegal, between Cape Town and Soweto. I was also struck by what bound people together in these places. In George Washington's first draft of his farewell address, he wrote, "We may all be considered as the children of one common country." The more I think about globalization and the interdependence it promises and demands, the more I share that sentiment. Now we must think of ourselves as children of one common world. If we wish to deepen peace and prosperity and democracy for ourselves, we must wish it also for the people of Africa. Africa is the cradle of humanity, but also a big part of humanity's future. I leave you with this thought. When I think of the troubles in Africa rooted in tribal differences, when I think of the continuing...
Shut the hell up, crime Bill Clinton. First, your punk ass has the nerve to talk about how Africa is the cradle of humanity. Well, you're right, but with the help of you and your friends like Savimbi and Shell Oil and dictators that you propped up like Mobutu, it'll be the deathbed of humanity. Then you have the nerve to yap about Sam becoming closer partners with Africa. No thanks, crime Bill. We know what happened the last time you guys became close partners with Africa. I wound up here. And then you have the nerve also to yip-yap about the sharing the sentiments of George Washington, that we are all becoming the children of one country and, in your vision, children of a common world. Yeah, you're right. Children of a corporate world, with corporate-sponsored school books, corporate schools, corporate-conditioned teachers, corporate-backed cops patrolling the campuses, with corporate-sponsored sports programs, with corporate drug testing if you want to play sports, all rounded up in corporate federal lies in the minds of the students so they'll turn out as hideous barbarians like, well, yourself. Slave time. Listening to 104.1, 93.7, 96.3, and sisters and brothers on the internet at love.com. Slave Revolt Radio time. Tonight, we got Gerald kicking it off with the Making It Plain news update, as we'll be kicking back some of those 41 bullets that pigs have a tendency to, you know, play target practice on us on. Then I'll be rolling into a commentary, and then we'll just wind it up with some more good old hearty capitalist bashing. So we have all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt Radio.
Break Breaking up big rocks on a chain gang. Breaking rocks and saving my time. Breaking rocks out here on a chain gang. Cause I've been convicted of crime. Hold it steady right there while I hit it.
And I think prisons are the most protected institution from outside accountability in our society. And we just know the whole basis of society, of democratic society, is accountability. You take that away, and you take a prison, which is already is bound, it's an enclosed institution. The guards are overwhelmingly outnumbered by the number of prisoners. The prisoners are powerless, the guards have power. The guards are fearful because they are, their numbers are, the ratio is so different. And so if you keep that institution unaccountable, where people can't visit without warning, bad things are almost inevitably going to happen. And the bad things happen and are easily covered up. I mean, it's a joke among guards that they beat up somebody. The answer to the public is they fell down a set of stairs. And, you see, I think Jose is going to fall down a set of stairs, which means they're going to take him down and beat him. And so that, now, this doesn't mean that all guards are savages. It doesn't mean that all prisons are filled with savagery. But the whole pressure of that incarceration is to produce savagery.
Wanna see my sweet honey baby? Wanna break this chain off and run? I wanna lay down somewhere shady. Lord, it sure is hot in the sun. Hold it steady right there while I hit it. Yeah, I reckon that oughta get a bit wicked and wicked, but I still got the devil long to go. Breaking up big rocks on a chain gang. Breaking rocks and saving my time.
Brothers and sisters, and friends, and I see some enemies. In fact, I think we'd be fooling ourselves if we had an audience this large and didn't realize that there were some enemies present.
I'm Gerald Smith, and this is your Making It Plain News Service.
Am I coming in here?
Okay. Well, brothers and sisters, unfortunately, the four cops that murdered Amadou Diallo are going to walk free. The verdict of the jury was not guilty on all counts. Now, we'll get into that later on in this broadcast, but we're going to talk about the police. We're going to talk real true about the police. All right? Let's start off region by region. Let's talk about Los Angeles. As you may be aware, the worst is yet to come for the LAPD. And that is, as the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office prepares to seek the reversal of 8 more convictions tainted by alleged police misconduct, law enforcement officials predicted Wednesday that the Los Angeles Police Department's corruption scandal will unfold for years to come and will involve the overturning of hundreds of other criminal convictions. We might bring to your attention this present corruption scandal began with Officer Perez removed 8 pounds of cocaine from the evidence room of the LAPD in downtown Los Angeles. All right, so they talking to Police Chief Bernard Parks, meanwhile, told the city council that quote, lack of oversight, unquote, on the part of supervisors all the way up to the chain of command allowed corruption at the Rampart Station to go unchecked. Surprise, surprise. the nerve of these people. Now, here's another L.A. scandal. It doesn't just, that's not the only one. You got to take your pick here today. There was a robbery, a bank robbery, and it appears that the police consciously and deliberately allowed the perpetrator of this robbery to bleed to death. A former police officer who stood by while a bank robber bled to death testified he could not see the man's gaping wound that was the result of a wild shootout with the police. Retired officer John Futrell also said he canceled an ambulance call. Canceled an ambulance call. Not failed to make. Canceled an ambulance call because he felt that help was more urgently needed for more than a dozen wounded officers and civilians. A federal jury began hearing arguments Thursday on whether officers let gunman Emil Mascherano bleed to death. Well, obviously, they let the man bleed to death, but ain't no question. The real question is, what are we going to do about it? You know? And Tracy brought to my attention that this was a very similar situation with the killing of Lou Grenage and his father. Recently, 1994, right? In Oakland, policemen get shot invading the home of a black citizen who defended his home. And at the end of the shootout, Lou and his dad are laying on the ground bleeding, and they just let them lay there and bleed. They didn't make any serious attempt to get them to a hospital, which would only take a few minutes.
And on top of that, you can hear on tape the ambulance drivers complaining back to the hospital, the Highland Hospital, to the surgeons and stuff, who had told them to bring back all three wounded participants, the cop, Luke, and his father. And the ambulance drivers are saying, we tried to, we know that's procedure, but the cops wouldn't let us. Uh-huh. They made the ambulance drivers only take back the cop, and then wouldn't allow them to take Luke and his father until about 45 minutes later.
By that time.
And it was adios amigos by then.
Yeah. Intentional. So here in L.A., due to all of this scrutiny and these scandals, what you have is the so-called pig, so-called union. Cops don't have unions because they don't produce value. They're not workers. But their organization is now calling for a probe of the L.A. police. In an extraordinary step that reflects the plummeting public confidence in the Los Angeles Police Department over a growing corruption scandal, the union representing police officers undercut the department's chief yesterday and demanded an independent investigation of the growing evidence of police brutality and corruption, I might add. But listen, now, so what is this all about, y'all? I think the Chronicle gave up the ghost here when they said plummeting public confidence. Police activity, the way that the police play this role in society, is a confidence game. They pretend, with the help of the head-fixing industry and the politicians, that they're protecting the public against evil, against the bad guys. And in exchange, they abuse everyone that they can get their hands on. Okay? Well, in fact, now we see they're worried because people are starting to wonder, well, damn, they're so busy selling dope and doing all the other stuff they're doing, how could they possibly really be protecting us? Here is an editorial from the Chronicle, 222-2000. Just listen to how it starts off. But this is the ruling class organ. The maddening police corruption scandal in Los Angeles is seemingly widening by the minute, eroding the trust of all and giving credence to classes of people, I guess classes of people like us, who have long decried police procedure as arbitrary, vindictive, and vicious. They're worried, y'all. Now, the real question is, can we take advantage of this? Can we educate millions? Millions, because that's what we need to do, and make sure people understand and come to the conclusions and take the proper actions that can seriously lay some political blows to the police and prevent them, you know, from building this phony image of protector of all from all evil and all this old madcap crap.
And on that Shameless file that I kicked last week, that's basically the spin, the diversion spin that Garcetti was trying to throw out there. Because you heard him again and again, one, trying to separate himself from the cops for the time being, even though they're on the same side. And two, like, rest assured, he's going to get the job done. You can trust us. Now, this is the same fool that has done a legendary job in helping keep under wraps what happened to Geronimo until we basically had to pry him out of there. But now we're supposed to trust him. Yeah. You know, this is the same fool that intentionally ignored all of the Christopher Commission's suggestions, not only on the police misconduct, not only on terrorist organizations like the Vikings, Wayside Whiteys, Cavemen, etc., etc., but on prosecutorial misconduct. And he just keeps sweeping it aside because, as I said last week, he is the maintenance man.
That's right.
So this is the way the game is being played.
That's right. Now look, here's another aspect of the game that we often lose sight of. Within the police departments and other armed forces in the United States and in law enforcement agencies, there is intense racism. So intense that, in fact, blacks in the Secret Service have accused that agency of bias in promotions. This from Washington, February 23rd. Last year, after 16 years as an agent in the insular fraternity of the Secret Service, Reginald G. Moore had made it to the most prestigious post in the agency as a lead agent on President Clinton's protective detail. Entrusted with Mr. Clinton's life, Mr. Moore seemed to be poised to advance to the agency's managerial ranks. But even though his written evaluation for 1999 shows that he was among the most outstanding agents of his rank, Mr. Moore, who is black, said he was denied a promotion and given the task of training the white agent promoted ahead of him. When Mr. Moore was reassigned to a counterfeiting squad in Dallas, he decided to defy the Secret Service traditional code of silence. He did everything he was supposed to do in serving, and he was betrayed, he felt.
What's also kind of scandalous is these Negroes and all these little professions are getting slapped around because in the this little security team for Clinton, remember a couple of years ago, a couple of them also had lawsuits along with other black folks all around the country against Denny's,
right.
Old raggedy Denny's, because
their
white counterparts were allowed to eat in the Denny's. And the black ones,
can you imagine,
that were just protecting Clinton's life, actually, there's some restaurants in Oakland that wouldn't serve him just because he is protecting his life, but that's another issue. But old Raggedy Denny's wouldn't let the Negroes sit down. So,
can you imagine that? We talking about the home of the Grand Slam, 299. We ain't talking about no high class, you know, restaurant. This is shameful. But, you know, and then they tell you after they discriminate against your black ass, they tell you to jump in front of a bullet so we can keep this going for another 400 years. No, thank you. Listen to this. This is more. We can't get away from these. This, because I'm going to get into the Diallo case in 1 second. But recently, and this from the 22nd of February, a freed man requests crime system reform. Now check this. This from Los Angeles again, to show you how the police and the judicial system function there. Blood tests used to convict him for a 1986 rape and robbery were scientific fraud and point to the need for serious reform, says a man who spent 12 years in prison for a crime that he did not commit. And I quote, "I hope my sons don't get bitter or become prejudiced towards any particular group. because of what happened to their father, Herman Atkins said, as his eyes teared. To be labeled as a rapist, that's the worst form of label you can have, he said. Atkins, flanked by former O.J. Simpson attorneys Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, called for reform. This case should be a wake-up call to get rid of the problems within the system and allow post-conviction DNA testing, Neufeld said. Atkins, who is 34, was convicted of rape and robbery in 1988 based on blood tests and the testimony of two eyewitnesses. Despite his claims of innocence, he was convicted and sentenced to 45 years in prison. Atkins was freed last Friday, from the Ironwood State Prison in Blythe after DNA evidence proved he could not have been the person who committed the rape and robbery that he was convicted of. Isn't that something?
Now, this is getting hella scandalous.
No, listen, and every time we get our hands on it, we're going to bring it to you.
Because Jet Magazine, if you've been checking that out for a while, it was almost turning into like Jet the Released, you know, wrongly convicted magazine. Because every week, some brother or sister was getting out after about 19, 20 years and stuff. And now this is another brother in the long list of wrongly convicted by Barry Scheck and company. So while, Darden and what was that other prosecutors for the states?
Oh, that woman, Marsha
Clark. Yeah. While they're off golfing and, you know, writing books and on game shows and stuff.
And crying because O.J. got away.
Right. Barry Scheck and Neufeld are still out there grinding and getting the truly innocent off.
That's right. And in fact, you know what? Just recently, O.J. did a press conference. Oh, yeah. And he said, look, he said, if I didn't have my own lawyers, they would have did me just like they did these people here in L.A., these gang people. If I had to use a public defender, they would have did me just like they did them. And you know what? He's right.
Well, there was one particular writer who was yapping about, I mentioned him in my commentary, the O.J. trial decision, Rebirth of a Nation, who said that the mere suggestion that police plant evidence on people is scandalous. It's a crime.
Wow.
The mere suggestion.
They wish it was, don't they? Now look, here's another angle to look at the way police and particularly top officials in the armed forces agencies and police agencies and spy agencies are dealt with and compare it to how they deal with citizens. The former chief of the CIA apparently left secrets open to theft, an agency investigator has said. Now, investigators scoring the home computers used by John M. Deutsch, the former director of Central Intelligence, found 42 secret documents and fragments of 32 others and could not rule out the possibility that some of the information may have been stolen by hackers, according to a report by the agency's inspector general that was released February 23rd. Mr. Deutsch's mishandling of the information, much of it in the form of letters and memorandums to President Clinton, left highly classified programs and secret code words vulnerable to theft, either through telephone modems or burglary of his home in Maryland or Massachusetts, the report found. Whether any of the information was stolen or compromised remains unknown, the report concluded. Now, I just bring this up to you again, because right now there's a man in prison for the exact same infraction. He was a scientist. Was it the Livermore? Was it the Livermore facility? Lee. I'll go in depth on this later, but I'm just showing you. The CIA guy, Janet Reno says she's not going to prosecute. But Lee is in prison right now, awaiting trial. They didn't put such a heavy bail on his butt. Lee, by the way, is Asian American. Well, there's a lot of ways to deal with this stuff. I'll show you one on the international level, I have to share this with you. I feel responsible to make sure you see this, because the Mexican police had to be freed after a 12-hour ordeal. That's right, the police had to be freed. The officers were seized by what the paper called a mob. It looked like it was just the people. After they jumped on a college, they raided a college. Hundreds of enraged townspeople seized and captured at least 65 state policemen and set them free after holding them for nearly 12 hours in a dispute over a rural teacher's school. Officials from Hidalgo State and the town of Tepetepec met briefly yesterday to discuss the conflict over the El Mexi Rural Teachers College, but there was no immediate word of any agreements. Hundreds of state police raided the school early Saturday to end a student takeover that had started January the 5th, arresting some of the students outside the school about 50 miles north of Mexico City. Learning of the police raid, hundreds of town folks converged on the school. Most of the police managed to leave, i.e. escape, run, get away. But at least 65 who remained found themselves overwhelmed by the crowd, apparently after a brief clash. The village revolt against the state troopers, some of whom were left with nothing but their undershorts on, was mainly an explosion of the resentment of people around the country and how they feel towards police, who are regarded as venal, violent, and overbearing. The police were stripped of their shirts, and at least one of the trousers were tied together and marched to the town plaza, where they were held throughout the day. One policeman was shot. Seven people, including police officers and protesters, were injured, and possibly a dozen police patrol cars were burned, said the state government spokesman Luis Kiam. The policemen were finally freed late Saturday night after state officials freed the hundreds of students and supporters arrested at the school, as well as those at a sit-in at the state capitol building before dawn Saturday. The school has long been a hotbed of leftist political activism, and many residents of the town apparently supported the student demands for removal of a few school administrators they accused of corruption and for increased scholarships. Well, that's one way to deal with them. Beat their ass, took their clothes off, took their weapons from them, and just held them in the middle of the town.
I hope the New York police are listening.
Oh, man. I hope the American workers are listening. That's one way. Listen. And right here in Berkeley, the police are starting on a campaign against the young people without Proposition 21 being passed. The store owners have been crying. Oh, they won't let us make no money. No, it's not that they ain't got nothing to sell that's worthwhile. It's the kids' fault, right? Well, to their credit, these young people got together. After the police raided the school, one time they did a thing, was an anti-truancy thing, and they arrested about 100 kids with police vans and stuff, and the police bus, and they arrested these children. But you know what? What you had was the downtown situation led to the students actually resisting. Excuse me. The students called a demonstration. They organized themselves, and they had a mass demonstration against that sweep when they were all arrested. And consequently, guess what happened? Very interesting. The police apologized to the students. Hey, get the message? All right, now, briefly, before we go into Amadou Diallo, I want to just briefly mention, you know, we got this election coming up, and there is an activist running for school board in District 3. Her name is Tanya Kapner. And, well, you should just be aware that she considers herself to be an alternative to those Democrats and Republicans running for election. Also, there's a few of these, oh my goodness, I'm sorry, but you know, there's a few of these ballot measures that we haven't ever talked about, and I just want you to go find out for yourself. I'm going to mention a few of them, and I hope that you vote, you know, your conscience. 1A is going to give Indians the right to gamble on their tribal lands, even though they won that Proposition 5 thing last election. Some judge struck it down, and apparently this 1A is going to settle it. I recommend, I think it's only fair to vote yes and give the Indians the right to vote, to do their business on their land. Another very important is Proposition 18. Check it out now, because it expands the death penalty. It seems that in nearly every election we are faced with another measure to extend just a little bit more crimes which are punishable by the death penalty.
Which is pretty scandalous, because they just got through executing that great-grandmother in Texas the other day. So now, with the execution of younger and younger people, they have high chair electrocution, electric high chairs. They got the electric chairs, and now electric wheelchairs.
Oh, that's dope. I mean, 62 years old, man. And actually,
organic brain damage
and
abused like mad.
Serious mitigating factors. Serious mitigating factors.
But old Shrub Bush just threw him in the shrubs.
That's it. Your next president, unless you struggle, create something else. Ain't the Gore's no better, but you know. So we recommend the no on 18. Now, how about this? Increased penalty for killing some police. Imposes life without possibility of parole for second-degree murder of BART or California State University police officers. No. They just put more, they try to make these more and more of these protected cop things. Well, you see what the cops are doing. It seems the time has come to stop the murders committed by police officers and not be worrying about, special preferences to give to the police officers. Now, of course, 21, no. Remember that one. 22, that's the 21 is the juvenile justice thing, to send the kids to jail, adult prison. 22, ban same-sex marriages, no, we think. Let's see. There are a lot of them that we haven't heard of. We'll mention some more in our next program. But we do want to mention also, in Oakland, the school board hacking scheme by Jerry Brown. All right? He wants to add 3 new members to the Oakland school board appointed by, guess who? Him. No. Let's have real elections and let the people pick who they want to represent them. And that's going to be it now on the election stuff. Let's get to Diallo. Listen, this has to be one of the most important cases of police brutality that has occurred in the 90s. And there have been a lot of them, y'all. There's been a lot of them. This trial took about 3 weeks to a month to complete. The officers involved, Sean Carroll, Edward McMillan, Kenneth Boss, and Richard Murphy, fired 41 times at West African immigrant in the vestibule of his own apartment building in the Soundview section of the Bronx soon after midnight on February the 4th, 1999. The plainclothes cops were members of something called the Street Crime Unit that had become notorious in black and Hispanic neighborhoods for its stop and frisk policies. And they said they thought that Diallo had a gun. Now, that's delusional. Man didn't have no gun. So if he didn't have a gun, what does that say about these cops? They see a black man, they see a wallet, they see a black man with a gun. Crazy. By the way, y'all, today, what happened was the jury found the cops not guilty of all counts. I'll get into that a little bit too. But first, I want to explain to you.
But one thing on that about the wallet bit too, you know, with some of the stuff I played in Uncovered last week about a couple of the cops, McMillan or McMurphy and Boss, it's pretty clear that these coward cops really don't give a damn. I'm not convinced at all that they, you know, thought his wallet was a gun or mistook it because of, you know, some deranged position they have. Because one thing that Amadou Diallo's roommate uncovered and brought to light was the fact that Amadou kept his key in his wallet. So who knows how long Amadou had that wallet out. And on top of that, McMurphy and Boss have been into some highly violent incidents in the past, and one was in one about an hour before they gunned down Amadou. And I may kick that excerpt back off again, you know, to let you guys hear what went down. But one thing is clear, the guys who got jacked up, they thought that, you know, the cop was on something because of the way he was acting and stuff when he attacked them and stuff. So, who knows exactly about, you know, this whole wallet bit. I think it's more of a diversion and an excuse and stuff. All this, where's the gun? Where's the gun? That's the first thing I thought, you know, where's the gun?
Yeah, maybe the boy was on drugs. I don't know. But you know something more importantly, though, that I just want to go into what this street crime unit was about. Their task was to disarm New York City, to get all the so-called illegal guns, right? So what? What's wrong with that? Well, let's look at exactly how they went about it, right? Here are some statistics. During the first Giuliani term, the street crime unit made up less than 2% of the police force, but confiscated 40% of all the illegal weapons seized by the city. Now, here's how they went about it. The unit's officers frisked, get this, 27,061 people in 1998, but they arrested only 4,647 people. More than 22,000 people were not even accused of wrongdoing. They were just stopped and searched. At random, y'all. At random. In the 15 months that ended last March, city police officers in and out of the special unit stopped 56,499 people while looking for weapons, according to the State Attorney General's office. Weapons were found on 2.6% of those stopped. So we talking 3 out of every 100 people that they stopped, they found weapons on. That means that 97% of these people were stopped for no reason.
Or they claimed they found weapons on.
Okay, I'm saying if these statistics are accurate, you're quite right. So, you know, you're wondering what, if this is not crossing the line in terms of violating people's dignity, their civil liberties, etc., what is?
And it's designed to do that.
Exactly.
It's designed to beat you down mentally and say, look, these guys, quote unquote, own the night.
That's right.
Which is one of their slogans.
But see, and also get this here, Tracy. The Rampart Division, where you have this guy Perez stealing the 8 pounds of cocaine.
Right.
He was part of a special anti-gang unit.
Correct.
You see, these little elite units cultivate a certain psychosis that you guys got to be tough. You guys got to be the real cops. You guys got to get in there and don't, no monkey business, man. Just, you know, just go out. Guess what? They had a quota. You had to bring in one gun a month. If you didn't bring in a gun a month, then you back on the street in the uniform. Wait a minute. Quotas are illegal. Now ask me how I know. Because they used to have quotas for tickets. And what happened was somebody sued them, and the Supreme Court said that setting quotas for police work is illegal because it forces police to do shit that they wouldn't normally do. You see? So here again, we're going backwards, y'all. They are disregarding all of the victories and the legal clarification that's taken place in the last 30 years and just doing what the hell they want to you. And they'll continue to as long as you, and I mean you collectively, not individually, allow it. Because now they're going to let the son of guns off the park. It's a scandal.
Right, and this is all part of that criminalization process. A little while ago, we kicked off an incident where some guy wanted to be a cop. And he found out he couldn't be a cop because, according to their books, he had been arrested. And he's all, look, I've never been arrested for nothing. And how it turned out in New York, they got this little procedure where if a cop comes up and talks to you, you know, about an incident, like, did you see this? Just questions you about something. It's like a verbal arrest, even though you're not charged with anything, and then they just put it on your record.
Wow.
And it can have an obvious hindrance on your career when you try to get some little gig. I'm not talking about some pig gig, but a real gig.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, some arrest record shows up.
Man, the death of the 22-year-old man, Amadou Diallo, who had come to the United States from his native Guinea and was working as a street peddler, sparked tremendous anger among working people and wide sections of the population. A grand jury indicted the police officers on second-degree murder charges, and their trial began January the 31st, almost exactly a year after the killing. They moved it to Albany, and people had some trepidation about that, because they didn't think they could get a jury that would let them go in the Bronx. So they consciously did that.
Oh, yeah.
Jury selection took about 2 days with a panel of 8 whites and 4 blacks selected. So here is something else for the nationalists who's always talking about you got to have blacks on the jury. Yes, we need to have black people need to be on the jury like anybody else. But it's no guarantee. If they don't have any consciousness, it's no guarantee that you're going to get, anything resembling justice. Because, in fact, there are other ways that they can tamper with the jury. Yes, I said tamper. Yes, it's tampering. For instance, in some cases where a prosecutor wants to get the death penalty, they will ask people, do you think the death penalty is right? And if people feel that the death penalty is, they don't support the death penalty, they will exclude them from the jury. What this has done, we have found, is that death penalty, pro-death penalty juries tend to also be pro-cop and pro-prosecution. So it tends to put a certain tilt on the, the conviction, or a guarantee almost that the prosecutor will get a conviction. There are other ways. Dig this. The number of people that serve on juries in the United States that have relatives that are employed in law enforcement, that is cops, prison guards, etc., is far larger and out of disproportion to their numbers in society at large. So notice this. When Hurricane Carter was convicted for the first time, the detective set up a little code with the DA flagging people who had connections to law enforcement or who that detective thought through his investigation would be likely to deliver a guilty verdict. They actually went that far to convict Hurricane Carter. And I'm sure since he did it then, that's something that they normally do to ensure convictions.
Well, in Philadelphia when all the scandals were breaking out initially and stuff, you know, the reviewing of over 100,000 cases and stuff. It also came out that the prosecution team was actually giving like seminars on how to gauge people, techniques on if people had certain lived in certain areas, area codes, et cetera, et cetera. Right. They were too, quote, open-minded, so you had to jackboot them out.
Right.
So you shoot for certain income brackets too, and those type of economic things and factors. And they used it, even though it was illegal, all to their advantage.
And look, you know, let me share. So what happened? So when Amadou Diallo was killed, understand this is on the heels of the Louima thing, what happened to Abner Louima, a Haitian gentleman who was sodomized with a stick in the bathroom of the 70th precinct. Volk was given 30 years for that. In fact, that case is still going on right now in New York. What happened was, it was just an explosion of activity. And a series of demonstrations started to take place in downtown New York, despite the fact that they were not permanent, they were not legal on a certain level. These demonstrations generated 1,166 arrests. People had enough. Initially, Giuliani said, some Democrats said, you should talk to the family, Mr. Giuliani, and express your grief. Giuliani said, I ain't talking to nobody. Well, after this series of demonstrations broke his political back, he was talking to everybody. Because it was clear that the citizens of New York had had enough of this madness. 1,166 people had the charges dropped for demonstrating, blocking traffic, and all of the other things that they did in protest to Diallo's murder. And at that point, that's when they indicted the cops. See, they would never have even indicted these cops if masses of people had not taken direct action. Now, that's what actually happened. Here we got a situation now. They scared the deaf in New York. They're talking about the Rodney King syndrome. I was recently in New York, and I went to some of the meetings. They planned to have a demonstration the day after the verdict, which I guess means tomorrow in New York. We'll get back to you with details on that. But this stuff is really egregious. This man was shot 41 times. He was unarmed. 41 times. Shot 19 times. And they trying to let him go. And I tell you, it's a danger to all of us because it's a go-ahead sign for the cops is what it amounts to. I guess the trial revealed many of the details of his death, and the defendant's testimony was clearly designed to humanize them. One of the things they did, they had the cops crying on the stand. I said, man, don't nobody care nothing about you crying. Shit, you be crying when you get to jail, you be crying.
Well, see, the thing is that on court TV, I heard one of the commentators babbling on how that was such powerful testimony and all of that junk. So they were setting up this spin, even for people who may not have seen it, you know, as them being reporters and so on and so forth.
It's worse than that. See, they actually even talked about the like, how many, in the New York Times, they were talking about how many children these cops had. Talking about their children. What they were saying, y'all, now don't get me wrong here, because I don't hate white folks, but I'm going to be really honest with you here. They were saying, look at these white men. They feel bad. Ain't that good enough? They said, look at these white men. They got children and families. You want to put these good people in jail behind it, you know what?
Yeah, that's basically, don't destroy these guys' lives over these niggas. This nigga, that's basically it.
That's sad. Deeply racist. And that's why the anger in New York is very, very, very high. The prosecution and defense testimony had differed primarily on certain little details. And in an unprecedented thing, what we saw was the prosecution and the defense united and came to the jury and offered lesser charges. Now, this was unprecedented. How often do you have the prosecutor get together with the defense and come up with lesser you know, charges.
Well, they were doing a half-assed job anyway.
That's right. And we see the results of it now. The prosecution even declined to cross-examine the last defense witness, a so-called police expert. From a legal standpoint, it was fairly clear from the beginning of this case that it would be difficult to prove that the police were guilty of intentional murder. A second-degree murder conviction based upon a depraved indifference to human life, however, was definitely possible. But the prosecution did everything it could not to obtain it. You know, there are definite political reasons for this, and far more than the fate of the individual defendants is involved. The district attorney's office would have had to show the role of the police in terrorizing poor neighborhoods and the history and role of the street crime unit in particular behind this unprovoked killing. Needless to say, the prosecutors had no interest in doing that. The political establishment and its judicial representatives want to see this matter ended. And that's what they think they've got. But what they think they have ended has only begun. People are not going to lay down and take this in New York. You can guarantee that there are going to be some response from the people. I hope it's organized. I hope it's not a riot. Because the people, I just listened, 150 people organized were at the place in the Bronx where Diallo was shot. And the cops were stopping them from marching. The cops have announced there will be no marches or demonstrations in New York City tonight. Now, what is that? That's martial law or something.
That's Seattle.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, man. That's pretty serious. So, I guess this wasn't even a compromise verdict. The defendants in this case are probably far more typical of the police force as a whole than the psychopathic Justin Volk that I spoke about earlier, the New York City cop who was convicted last year of brutally assaulting Abner Louima and sentenced for 30 years. The four officers in the Diallo case did not set out to kill their victim and were undoubtedly shaken when they saw what they had done. At the same time, they were certainly indifferent to his fate. Their reaction was far more reflection of what they feared would become of them. That's what they was worried about. And they not worried about pulling that trigger because they know that, generally speaking, when they kill and maim in the name of the law, nothing is going to happen to them. And that's what this trial has confirmed. It's very serious.
And on top of that, most of the time it doesn't reach this state. So most of the time they're able to finesse it. I mean, look, after they killed Amadou, the first thing they did was run up to his roommate's apartment, roused him up and say, who does Amadou have any enemies? You know, took him down there, showed him the body. Do you know who would have done this to him? And all of that. So it was clear right then and there that they were just going into their normal procedure of cover up corruption in the cops. The thing is that this whole thing kind of exploded more than they're used to, and they weren't able to do the Perez trick.
Right. And it was the mass demonstrations that exploded, and that's what prevented them from just covering this up. Now, I guess the killing of Amadou Diallo was the product of unprecedented social polarization in New York. The cutbacks and the collapse of essential social services and the law and order crusade, complete with arrest quotas from a skyrocketing prison population, the police are trained and indoctrinated to regard working class communities as enemy territory and minority youth and workers as fair game. These were the circumstances under which they reacted as the I've explained in the past, it's a combination of hostility and hatred of the working class, racism, indifference, fear, and panic. Indeed, the testimony of the police on the witness stand was just absolutely pitiful, and it confirmed this. As for the Democratic and Republican politicians, their role is summed up in the behavior of the presumed rivals in the upcoming New York senatorial contest. New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani and Hillary Clinton. Giuliani has trumpeted his support for the police, portraying them as victims of a so-called anti-police campaign, which he has equated to racial and religious bigotry. Do you believe that? As for Mrs. Clinton, while posing as concerned over police brutality, she recently sent a long letter to New York's police union apologizing to them for using the word murder in connection to Amadou Diallo. Replying to the president of the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, she said she, quote, clearly misspoke, unquote, because, and I quote, only a jury can decide the police defendant's guilt or innocence, and I did not mean to suggest otherwise, unquote. The Democratic candidate went on to salute, and I quote, our brave men and women in law enforcement, unquote, and to attribute the drop in the crime rate to the hard work of our officers who face tremendous risk every day.
This is a normal tactic. When Rodney King got the old, you know, typical slave in the plantation treatment, Bush had made a few statements, you know, about, you know, the conduct of the police and everything, because it was so obvious, it was on video. But lead Nazi Gates then, you know, had to, you know, make sure that they got things in proper order and sent them a letter, and then also made some public statement about certain public officials jumping the gun and stuff. And sure enough, Bush and others just got right in line and straightened up and did little apologies here and there. So, this is a pretty common trend about one first comes out, makes a statement about, you know, we can't tolerate this stuff, jumps up and down, takes a few pictures with their face looking all stern, and then the cops respond in earnest, and then they, okay, you know, and that type of thing.
But worst of it is her attributing the drop in crime to the hard work of, quote, our officers. Yeah, they are her officers who face tremendous risk every day. Fact of the matter is, one, cops don't face that many risks. Truth of the matter is, they very rarely. They kill each other and themselves more often than anybody else kills them. And the other thing is that they do not stop crime. That's out. What the drop in crime can be much more attributed to the increase in work opportunity than any other factor that I can think of.
Also, as some former black cops have often stated, they talked about how, you know, they're able to easily manipulate the quote unquote crime rate. You know, this is just easily done by what they report and don't report. So often when they want to make a particular candidate or, you know, official look bad, they just fudge it in a way that makes it look like crime is going rampant in a particular area. And then when it's someone that they're more in line with, supporter, you know, Ghoul of Iani, then they just, you know, kind of back off and stuff and so on and so forth. And what this helps does is perpetuate the whole militarization of society and the police force, because if you look throughout a lot of these broadcasts on the corporate media, they keep yapping about, well, you know, as soon as this thing happened, I blew up some fools a few weeks ago. As soon as this thing happened, the chief over there in New York pulled off, and then crime has been going up and up and up in that same Bronx area and stuff. So they've been trying to use this as a means to justify
murder.
You know what happened, right? And they often try to offset it is like, if we want to make our streets safer, we have to have the cops crack down hard, as if one goes with the other.
But the news has some learning.
Absolutely wrong. Absolutely false. But unfortunately, the American people are very vulnerable to that form of head fixing. The answer, and what the cure is, will require the building of a revolutionary organization that is deeply rooted amongst the masses of people.
with a man.
That's what we need. A revolutionary workers' organization with a program that points the way forward. That's all for right now for the Making It Plain News Service. Please don't touch that dial.
Soothe in contemplation, that burning hole and aching thigh. Your stubbornness is of the living, and cruel anxiety is about to die. Freedom!